regrettable decision. When I was a teenager, there was a pop singer called Meatloaf who came out with a very popular item at that time that upset many parents, entitled Bat Out of Hell. On that album was a very popular song entitled Paradise by the Dashboard Lights, in which a young man tries to go all the way with his girlfriend while parked in a parked car. In the heat of a moment, or heat of the moment, the young man promises her to love her till the end of time. Well, then in a really funny twist at the end of the song, it concludes with him singing, "Now I'm praying for the end of time because I don't think I can spend another minute with you." The song is funny because it shows the folly of making rash decisions. Have you ever made a decision that you have regretted? Agreed to do something for someone or be present at some event and then anguished that you wish your word wasn't your bond? So what do you do? Do you keep your promise or do you renege on it? Children are always vexed with their parents or teachers when they break their word. How many times have we heard a child whine to us, "But you promised"? The reasons for going back on our word with a child is really irrelevant. All they care about is what they are missing out on. In the book of Judges, we read about a man named Jephthah. It's in Judges 11 if you want to read the whole story, who seems like such a unlikely candidate to lead Israel. He was a rough and very tough man. He had a hard life too, and most of his life he sought just to be accepted by his own people. He was born of the son of the clan head named Gilead, but his mother was a prostitute, and therefore his half-brothers disowned him and chased him away from his homeland. While he was on his own, Jephthah recruits a large band of rebels, if you like, probably other men who had been rejected by their families and their tribes, and this motley crew of men became very adept as warriors. His half-brothers, meanwhile, had been coping with the Ammonites who were seeking to destroy Israel. The half-brothers came to Jephthah and asked for his help, offering to let him be their ruler if he could just defeat the Ammonites. And after some dickering, Jephthah finally agrees. Now Jephthah at first tried to negotiate a truce with the Ammonites, but that failed. And so war was inevitable. And as proof that God can use anyone to accomplish his purposes, the Bible says that the Spirit of the Lord came upon Jephthah and he was able to recruit a very sizable army and go to war against the Ammonites. But Jephthah was a very brash man. He was very impulsive by nature and he did something that was incredibly foolish. Before his army faced the Ammonites, Jephthah made a vow. He promised to God that if he was given victory over the Ammonites, he would sacrifice the very first thing that came out of his front door to greet him when he returned home. Sure enough, Gilead defeated the Ammonites, and Jephthah returned home as a hero. You remember his vow? Well, who should come out his door first to greet him but his own daughter, singing and dancing in joy over her father's victory? Jephthah was heartbroken. He tore his clothes in anguish, for he had made a vow before the Lord, a vow he had to keep. And horrors of horrors, he did sacrifice his daughter. Now, on first read, we might wonder why God didn't stop him, like God stopped Abraham trying to sacrifice Isaac. We wonder why Jephthah just didn't go back on his word. We wrestle with the fact that this was a different time and a considerably different culture. But in the scriptures, vows are taken very seriously. They have to be adhered to. A similar thing happened in our gospel lesson today. It's an incident from the life of John the Baptist and also of Herod. Now, Herod here is the son of Herod the Great, who was the king who went out and ordered the slaughter of babies in Bethlehem that we remember at Christmas time. Herod Antipas had jailed John the Baptist. Why was that? Well, John was arrested because he spoke out publicly against the vile marriage of Herod to his sister-in-law. Herodias, Herod's illicit wife, was furious with John for essentially calling her an adulteress. Herodias desired John to be dead for sullying her name, but actually she did the sullying herself. So she hatches a plot on Herod's birthday. After Herod had drank a copious amount of wine, Herod's daughter, also called Herodias, came out and danced, probably in a very provocative way. And flushed with wine, Herod, pleased with that performance, recklessly promises his daughter anything she wants, including up to half his kingdom. Well, the young girl was unsure, so she rushes over and asks her mom what she should ask for. And here was the elder Herodias' chance. Ask for John the Baptist's head on a platter. And so she did. Herod was immediately sorry for his foolishness, but didn't want to break his word in front of his guests and be embarrassed. So word was sent to execute John and bring his head on a platter. The point of both lessons today is how we deal with our promises, how we deal with our vows, things that should never be taken lightly. However, the story in Mark about Herod seems like a very odd addition to the Gospels. There's a great deal of detail here, and we might be wondering, well, why? Well, the simple answer is that John was greatly revered by the early church as the forerunner of Jesus, and so Mark sought to preserve the story of his demise. As in many ways, John becomes the very first martyr as a follower of Jesus. Now, regardless of why the story was originally preserved by Mark, it does push us into a place we would rather not go. It calls us to account for our own foolish use of vows and promises. It demonstrates how making promises may seem a prudent thing at the time, but actually they can come back to bite us. I'm not sure if you are experiencing the same level of cynicism that I am experiencing of late. It seems to me that everyone is making grand promises that just never seem to pan out. It's about as epidemic as COVID, isn't it? Advertisers promise that their products will change your life, or theirs is the best one out there. A friend or a family member promises to return the money they've borrowed. A schoolmate promises to never reveal a secret and yet ends up posting it on Facebook. Our town council announces a major infrastructure project and promises that it'll be done on time and within budget. That in itself is just ludicrous. Frankly, I sometimes wonder if our politicians can even keep a straight face when they make such promises. And politicians in general get us all steamed up with promises after promises that never materialize. Earl Long, who was the former eccentric governor of Louisiana, said of another politician, "You know how you can tell that fella's lying? Watch his lips. If they're moving, he's a lion." A person who shall remain nameless told me that when he got married, they used the old vows with the words, "Love, honor, and humbly obey. He jokingly said that last promise was broken not two steps outside of the church after their wedding. The moment promises or vows enter the picture, someone is going to get disappointed or hurt. Now, I get why Herod and Jephthah felt trapped into keeping their vows. And Jesus says in Matthew 5:33-37, "Again, you have heard that the law of Moses says, 'Do not break your vows. You must carry out the vows you have made to the Lord.' Then Jesus says this, 'But I say, don't make any vows. If you say by heaven, it is a sacred vow because that's God's throne. And if you say by the earth, it is a sacred vow because the earth is his footstool. And don't swear by Jerusalem, for Jerusalem is the great city of the great king. Don't swear by my head, for you can't turn even one hair white or black. Just say a simple yes, I will, or no, I won't. Your word is enough." To strengthen your promise with a vow shows that something is wrong. In other translations, the phrase is translated, "or anything beyond this is from the evil one." Today, people take to saying ridiculous things like, "I promise on my mother's grave," or "on my firstborn's head." As kids, we used to say to each other, "cross my heart and hope to die," or "pinky swear." Jesus' point is really, really quite simple. If people cannot depend on the truth of your yes or your no, in other words, your word, then no amount of dressing it up with swearing on something else will make any difference at all. It actually may make things worse. Now, Herod was not a man of integrity. He'd proven that time and time again. He was reckless with his actions and his words. Therefore, Herodias, the mother this time, could exploit him. Are we reckless when it comes to our word? Can people depend on our simple yes or no? Are we people of integrity, which means people of wholeness? You know, Jesus was a person of integrity. His yes was yes and his no was no. He did not find it necessary to embellish his promises. Jesus' words never failed. What he said he would do, he did. Even down to the point of dying on the cross. The story of Herod reveals to us the main reason people swear on things or on people. The reason people make ridiculous promises that they will later regret. Herod's conscience had become distorted, had become warped. We erroneously think that a conscience is the part of your soul that tells us right from wrong. Excuse me, but that's not entirely accurate at all. Our conscience actually tells us what is right and what is wrong from our own perspective. A perspective that can be shaped by the experiences we have or by our beliefs in life. If, for example, you believe the Bible is the best way to live a good life, then you will most often let the Bible influence your conscience. If, however, you think that your own opinion is what matters most in life, then your conscience will let you make selfish decisions without any discomfort at all. Jesus in Luke 13:32 called Herod a fox. And yes, his intention was not to lavish praise on him. Just like today, the reference to a fox was to describe Herod as a conniving trickster. Herod put on a public facade or a persona that spoke of religious devotion and selfless public service, but it was all just fake. His self-interest was what guided his conscience. His vow to Herodias was a way of manipulating his guests. a way of making him look magnanimous or generous. Swearing on something or someone is a way of manipulating others' opinions of us to hide the true condition of our souls or our conscience. The question really comes down to is who or what is influencing your conscience? What is influencing your soul? And I think we've become very adept at reading the truth of one another's conscience. Just think of any recent scandal. You can guess that I'm going to suggest to you that Christ should be the one who influences your conscience. In a simple way, I could suggest you follow the advice in any situation to ask yourself, what would Jesus do? But I should warn you that if you let Jesus influence your conscience, you're going to be at odds with the rest of the world. The rest of the world will not understand. It will not agree or appreciate such a stance. When Jesus is the one whispering to you in those decisive moments, you may truly feel like it's you against the world. Tony Campola tells the story of a friend named Will Williman, who was serving as the dean of the chapel at Duke University when the tragedy of 9/11 happened. And tensions began to run very high among Christians, Jews, and Muslims on the campus of the university. So Will thought it would be a really good idea to have a forum in which a rabbi, an imam, and a Protestant clergy person could talk about the way in which their respective religions could propose that people, or how their respective religions should propose how people should respond to the tragedy of that terrorist attack. Now, the Muslim imam explained that according to the Prophet Muhammad, aggression against a Muslim brother should be avenged. The rabbi pointed out that if a Jew were to attack a Muslim, it would be his responsibility to seek punishment, even capital punishment, against the Jew who did. To all of this, Will Williman shrugged his shoulders and said, "You two make it very attractive to join either of your religions, because that's the way I would want to respond to evil. But Jesus teaches me to do something that is much harder. He tells me to love those who would do evil things, to forgive those who commit such horrible acts." If the response that comes out of you is impulsive and fits in with the world's expectations, I can almost guarantee that it did not come from Jesus. If your response to a difficult situation comes easily to you, it's likely it didn't come from Jesus. Jesus told us that if we follow him, it would be a narrow road. It will require sacrifice as we pick up our crosses. You know, when I was a kid, I love to watch cartoons, and the animators would often depict a character who was facing a major moral decision, having a little angel on one shoulder and a little devil on the other, and both of whom were trying to influence the main character. It was a very cute and effective way to portray that wrestling match that we often have in our own conscience. In each situation of this animation technique, the same question prevailed. Who or what is influencing your decision? We can make promises and make oaths. We can swear on Bibles or whatever, but that does not make us people of integrity if we're following the wrong person. Unless Jesus guides our conscience, everything that we promise is tenuous and fragile at best. And if Jesus is not guiding your conscience, I guarantee that your decisions will almost certainly be regrettable ones.